You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events, and we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Parker Palmer. Parker is founder and senior partner emeritus of the Center for Courage and Renewal and the author of 10 books, including Let Your Life Speak, The Courage to Teach, and On the Brink of Everything. Those books have sold over 1.5 million copies and have been translated into 10 languages. His work has been recognized with 13 honorary doctorates and with the William Rainey Harper Award, whose previous recipients include Margaret Mead, Elie Wiesel, and Paulo Freire. He holds a doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley, and his latest project is The Growing Edge, a collaboration with Carrie Newcomer that provides an online and in-person gift of sanctuary for listening to and following one's true self. Parker Palmer, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be with you.
I've been looking forward to this conversation because as I've been reading your work, there are so many parallels to the language of improvisation. We talk about making mistakes work for you and seeing all obstacles as gifts. In the beginning of your book, On the Brink of Everything, you write, quote, "My life has been graced, but it certainly hasn't been graceful. I've done more than my share of falling down, getting up, and falling down again. The falling down is due to missteps and gravity. The getting up is due to grace." This is where I think our worlds collide.
Yes, indeed.
And I think one of the reasons your work resonates with so many people and how unvarnished you are about examining your own life, you talk very honestly about that. And just honestly, from my world, for the last 2 years, my listeners of this podcast have really helped me carry myself through a very difficult journey. Our 16-year-old daughter, Nora, was diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago, and then she died a year ago last month.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But this is something you write about in the book and sort of the gift of sitting with people who are in pain and that there is no joy without suffering and there's no suffering without joy.
Yeah, exactly. I really feel for you and your family, and I know that's an ongoing suffering for anyone who has that kind of loss in their life. But the image of sitting at the bedside of a dying person has been an important one in my work with living people as I live my own life. Because I think it's the moment at which, when you're at the bedside of a dying person, you have to give up all pretension that you've got a fix or a solution or a cure for this thing, which is what we so often feel when someone comes to us with a problem. We want to advise them or fix them or save them in one way or another. And at the bedside of a dying person, you have to let go of that arrogance, really, that you can get inside another soul and you can know what he or she needs. And at the same time, you are compelled. It just feels morally, ethically, spiritually, existentially imperative to maintain a focus on that person that is trusting, that somehow conveys to them, however wordlessly, that you have the confidence that they can make this difficult journey into death, the journey we all have to make by ourselves. And so at that moment, we learn something about not being invasive or evasive. And I think that's a quality of relationship that a lot of people are looking for, but that we rarely find because we so often find people who want to fix us, kind of in and out, drive by fixing, and then they want to get out of the room because the burden of imagining that I can or should or have the power to save another person is oppressive for me and for them. And so we tend to do these drive-by caring things and get out as soon as we can, when what I think every human being wants and needs is simply being attended to at the most fundamental level, knowing that they're seen and heard and trusted to have the inner resources to make it through whatever it may be.
And I have very few, if any, regrets in terms of sitting with Nora. And she did not know she was dying. That came very quickly at the end. But we learned to be fiercely present in the moment with her, which again is drawing on an improv thing. And a lot of beginning improv students, we have to say, don't try to write the scene on the stage. You have to let it unfold with you. And simply by being present with the other person and listening to them, you will make the scene work. And so we have another phrase where we say, play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in.
That's really interesting to me because, as you know, one of my lifelong devotions is to teaching and teachers. Yeah. And one of the things I had to learn along the way, since the only kind of teaching that had been modeled for me was people delivering information, lecturing, I had to learn the discipline of going into a classroom, trusting that if I offered up a rich enough sort of primer of the pump, my students, if I listened to them with care, would give me back everything I needed to become a better teacher. They would throw in ideas that I didn't have. They'd throw in honest questions that I could help them find out how to answer. And I think every human relationship, personal and professional, becomes so much richer when we have that kind of active listening and focused attention.
We're just not, but we're not taught that way, right? And almost as we progress in schooling, we get creativity pushed out and farther and farther and farther. It's almost like early childhood should stay that way, or in the universe.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I love the improv metaphor. I've actually thought about it before and read a little about it, because what we're taught in school, and I must say in other settings of our lives as well, religious organizations, for example, is to live by a script. And the reason for that is the script has all the right answers. It just happens to be that those are answers to questions nobody's asking. So if you listen for the questions that people are asking and are willing to dance with them in an improv way, the dance metaphor is powerful for me. I think good teaching is good dancing. Right. And good parenting and good relationships or good dancing, then something new emerges that keeps one alive. You know, I've spent 50 years working independently as a writer and a traveling teacher and an activist. And the most boring thing I do is lecture because I know exactly what I'm going to say most of the time. But when the Q&A comes, or when I can open things up for a real live encounter, that's when things get interesting to me, because that's when I start learning. And I think it's a lot more interesting for the people I'm working with as well.
My wife is a longtime Second City teacher and director, and she talks about our work as being developed in conversation with the audience, which I think actually most work is. And this is the tragedy of the times we're living in too, is so many of us are denied that ability to sit with each other. I mean, I've been on 3 Zoom memorials And while they've been lovely, you know, it is not the same as being able to go sit Shiva or do, you know, be in community. How are you doing considering you're probably all holed up?
Yeah, we are. So I'm 81. My wife's just a few years behind me, and we've been quarantining ourselves in our home in Madison, Wisconsin since the 1st of March. We're both in high-risk categories, and yeah. So, you know, we followed our own guidance and good medical guidance on that one. You know, what's interesting to me, and I agree with you that we need, I'm desperate to get back to face-to-face, but not before, you know, it's safe to do so, and I'm not a danger to others or they're not a danger to me. What's interesting on Zoom, which we all spend a lot of time on these days, is that there you are in Chicago. I've never met you before. Mm-hmm. Here I am in Madison, but we're about 14 inches away from each other right
now.
Yeah,
we got our bookcases behind our
Exactly. Yeah, and we could Zoom in and find out mm-hmm. what each other is reading, right, mm-hmm. which they do on television all the time. But, I have live encounters in this format, like the one I'm having with you at this very moment. I didn't know what you're going to ask about or how mm-hmm. how this would go or who you were, but it's just a lot of fun to really improvise, which is the name of a good conversation. It's improv embodied, really, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the importance of framing. And it's interesting, you talk about wholeness in the book, but not as perfection, which some people I think it is. You say, quote, it means embracing brokenness as an integral part of life. And this is the duality that runs through On the Brink of Everything, which was my most recent read of yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had to come to that. I mean, you're right with your opening that how, you know, we need to make something good out of our mistakes, because my life is full of mistakes, as many people's are. And yet I can sit here at age 81 without regrets about those mistakes, because I feel like with a lot of help from my friends, I've been able to make something good out of, if not each and every one of them, out of the sort of aggregate of my mistakes. And so it has pained me to hear sometimes people talking about wholeness as if that meant reaching some state of perfection. The only perfection I know anything about is that, as you said, which embraces my brokenness as an integral part of who I am. You know, I know that you probably don't want to go down this road too far, but I'll just mention it briefly. I know that with a previous guest or two on this show, you've discussed depression, clinical depression. And as I've written and mm-hmm. spoken about, I've been there three times in my life, three very, very deep and challenging times when day by day I'm asking myself, is it worth living another day? And it has always been a struggle for months at a time, three times in my adult life. And yet, you know, there's so much to be learned from that. And I, by holding that, not in a judgmental way or not in an ashamed way, and eventually when I was ready, going public with it, I've felt this onset of a new kind of wholeness that I don't think gets talked about much, where we are able to show up as who we are. And in truth, at age 81, with mortality on my mind, as it should be, I can't think of a sadder way to die than with the realization that I never really showed up in the world as my true self, as who I am, as the sum and total of my experiences. And I've learned that by going public with struggles like clinical depression, I at least have a chance to be helpful to other people who are experiencing that but didn't know whether and how to talk about it, and for whom I can kind of run cover for a while until they can come into their own fullness.
There, so I kept a journal, a Caring Bridge journal, when Nora got sick, and then I just kept going after she died, and it became a grief journal, mm-hmm. and I did it for almost a year, and I cannot tell you how the level of real conversations with people who I previously never thought I would have, you know, accountants that I worked with, who would sit down with me and cry and talk about their own grief journey. And the thing I learned, and actually I'm not sad about it because but there's everyone that has pain. Everyone has a lot of pain.
Right.
A lot of grief, a lot of trauma that they're dealing with. I don't think I met someone who doesn't. And so the thing I noted when you talked about depression was you say, quote, "Eventually I developed an image that helped me understand how depression can have a befriending intent." Mm-hmm. And it was that thing of it released you a bit and to be able to be more open with the world and therefore people more open with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, Kelly, that hinged on a moment I had with a therapist that I was working with at that time. I found therapy very helpful and for short periods of time, medication. But this therapist said to me after listening carefully for quite a while, he said, "You seem to image depression, Parker, as the hand of an enemy trying to crush you. Would it be possible for you to begin thinking about imaging it as the hand of a friend pressing you down to ground on which it's safe to stand?" Well, that didn't, you know, ring a bell with me right away, but it intrigued me, even in my depressed state. And so I started holding that with in a kind of contemplative way, taking it seriously. And eventually I came to what for me has been a very important insight. And that was that I had been living my life at elevation. And there are all kinds of elevation one can live at. There's ego elevation. There's a lot of that going around. Mm-hmm. There's intellectual elevation, where we think if we just think the right thoughts, we can solve everything. There's spiritual elevation, up, up, and away kind of spirituality. And then there's ethical elevation, where somebody else's code of ethics, somehow you think you have to live up to that, even if it isn't truly yours. And so in depression, a key learning is none of that works. None of it works. You can't think your way out of it. Your ego is smashed, so it's useless. Your spirituality disappears because it's not just like being lost in the dark. It's like becoming the dark. There's if you're just lost in the dark, you can negotiate. You can feel around, see where there might be a door handle or a window, but not when you've become the dark. Then, you know, there's no leverage on that. And then the idea that you failed someone else's ethic makes ethics, your ethic, unusable. And so you sort of get down to basics, like what life is trying to be lived in me? Evidently, it's not the one I was trying to live at elevation. And the problem with living at elevation, of course, is that if you trip and fall, which we do many times a day, or I do anyway, you have a long way to fall, and you might well kill yourself. But if you're on the ground because of this befriending hand of something like depression, you can trip and fall all you want or need to, and
it's not a long fall.
Dust yourself off and get up and carry on. So I sort of live by that image.
It's really hard for people who don't suffer from depression to understand it. I don't, but I've had people I love do, and I don't think I the closest I came to understanding was reading William Styron. And of course, art, right, can provide you a language or an insight that just facts don't. And I think that's the same. So you talk about how poetry is so powerful for you. And this was, I read a lot of poetry as a young man, and then I didn't read any. And then during my grief journey, I just returned to Rumi, E. Cummings, Mary Oliver, Adrienne Rich, Galway Kinnell. I mean, it became just this. And I'm still as avid a poetry reader, and this, it seems to me, it's had redemptive powers for you too.
Yeah, very much so. Maybe kind of like you, I was, as a young man, you know, highly trained academically, I was one of those people who would read a poem that a friend recommended, and I'd say to myself, if this person has something to say, why don't they just come out and say it instead of beating around the bush, you know? And, but it's only when life gets serious for you that those metaphors and those ways of holding elusive experience, mysteries really, start to get traction in your life. You know, it's Emily Dickinson famously said, tell the truth, but tell it slant. Because if you try to confront it head on, it's too bright for your eyes. You'll be blinded and unable to cope. And I love the idea that poets tell all kinds of important truths on the slant. And we catch it through them out of the corner of our eye, the way we know that dim stars in the sky can't be seen head on. But if you turn your head and use all those receptors in the corner of your eye, you can see them. And I think that's what poets do. They kind of expand our bandwidth and allow us to take in these mysteries that have to be walked around rather than figured out. And then to hold them in ways that are life-giving in an ongoing manner.
I was just on a call the other day with our partners at the Cleveland Clinic. We developed an improvisation for caregivers program with my friend Ai-Jen Poo at Caring Across Generations and Cleveland Clinic. And we've been doing this for a few years now. And it's really about, and these are a lot of people who are dealing with loved ones who have Alzheimer's. And the idea, one of the central ideas is the yes and idea, which is, especially if they're in, you know, rather than blocking what they're talking about, yes and it and go with it. With that what seems to you a fantasy might not be a fantasy. It certainly isn't in their head. And you say in the book, quote, we need to reframe aging as a passage of discovery and engagement, not decline and inaction. I mean, we have a problem in this country with how we talk about aging, how we hide from it. And I don't know, my experience, I'm 54. I get smarter every day. I mean, I'm still dumb, but I gain wisdom. I enjoy life more. And there's studies to back a lot of this up.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I'm about 30 years ahead of you. I'll just say more wisdom and more gratitude and enjoyment to come.
Great.
It's how I'm experiencing it. And I do think that, you know, all of the great wisdom traditions have said something like you find in the rule of St. Benedict, the guy who founded monasticism in the 4th century. He said, daily keep your death before your eyes. Well, I read that when I was a young man, and it sounded pretty morbid to me, you know.
Right.
These days, it's really life-giving counsel, and it has been for me for many years, actually, because keeping your death before your eyes every day, whether you do that by choice or because you're compelled to do it, really deepens your appreciation of life and your appreciation of those little things with which we are always surrounded, and which we often overlook in the rush of sort of midlife, making a career, caring for a family, and all of that important stuff. But there's a kind of grace for me about being older. I'm blessed with pretty good health, although I do have those underlying conditions that I have to be watchful about. But I've known people in their older years and in their younger years who became seriously, gravely ill and suddenly found themselves living fuller and richer lives because of the flow of awareness and gratitude for what they did have, where the question became not why me, but why not me? I'm one of many in a world where everything grows old and dies, or dies before its time. Let us reckon with that fact, and let us wrap ourselves around our own lives appreciatively and see how we can reach out to those who are suffering and to those who might be redeemed or renewed by tapping more deeply into their own gratitude.
You write a lot in the book about getting out of your own way. And this is certainly a thing that we teach in improvisation, is almost all the beginning exercises are acts of meditation that are allowing you to be just others focused and not so concerned on yourself. And I love the phrase you said, dropping deep into my not knowing. Mm-hmm. This is where I think great art and I suppose great living comes from, is that ability of like, no, this is where the good stuff is, the things I don't know rather than things I do know.
I think so, absolutely. And it's also where great intellectual activity comes from. You know, my best professors were people who really welcomed, genuinely welcomed, what some teachers will call the stupid question, you know, mm-hmm. because the stupid question is the honest question. I mean, I often think back to my doctoral education at Berkeley, where it's hard for me to remember if ever an honest question was asked in class. The questions that were asked were little speeches in disguise designed to let the superhero professor understand that you knew what side your bread was buttered on, you know, that you were on the right side of the table. An honest question is, I just don't get this. Can somebody please explain it to me? And oftentimes, you know, as a teacher, I've had the experience many times, when somebody says something like that, I find myself, if I'm honest, asking a good question. What is this? How do I explain this? I obviously haven't done it very well yet. But all of this involves the kind of a certain psychological or spiritual maturity of not projecting your inadequacies on your students, but taking them on yourselves. Again, getting out of your own way so that you can stay with that riff on an improv stage, or stay with that riff in a classroom or in a conversation, and make something wonderful out of it that hadn't come to you before.
And the thing that you're battling is, of course, your own ego. And you write a lot about that. I remember when I first started going to therapy, like before my first session, my wife said to me, "Hey, Kelly, please don't try to win at therapy." and I like instantly knew what she meant. And I think it's akin to when you write in the book, quote, "All I can control are my own intentions and my willingness to give myself to them. May they always be to serve rather than show off."
Yeah, that was, I think I somewhere in there, I write about how giving a lecture in front of a huge audience, like 5,000 physicians, which I've done on occasion, used to just terrify me. You know, mm-hmm. these are smart people who... And I have no medical education, so how in heaven's name am I going to pull this off? And of course, being paralyzed with fear shuts down the brain and your capacity to express whatever might be on your mind. So I started working on that very consciously and realized that my purpose up there behind that podium wasn't to impress or show off or, you know, make myself look good. My purpose was to try to serve. And that's why I had accumulated this knowledge and why I had worked hard to craft a talk that I thought might serve the people in the audience. And if I could just remember that, if the question is not, what can I do to look cool up here, but how can I best serve these people, even if it means faltering and fumbling and exposing my own brokenness and my own not knowing, my own wondering, that actually leaves room for other people to walk into what you're saying or what you're writing or what you're performing on stage. I've always found that improv is very attractive to me because I can so easily put myself in that situation. Like, mm-hmm. whoa, what, you know, mm-hmm. There's openings there for me. It's not just, oh, look at these really cool people blowing me away with how quick they are. It's like, wow, what would I do in that situation, or something of the sort? You know, it's my story in some interesting way.
Well, it is. I mean, that's we ask for the audience for prompts. We are guided by laughter or lack of laughter in making these discoveries, and that's really what we're trying to do.
I've often thought you could do some really interesting research on where those prompts are coming from in people. You
yes.
Why does someone say Cleveland is the setting? It's like with great yes. energy in their voice.
No, you get a lot of Cleveland. That's very, very true. And you know, one of the things I've always loved about working at Second City is that you're constantly working with the next generation. So I got older. I mean, I started producing when I was 26, so I was the same age as Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers and all those people I was working with. Mm-hmm. And then I kept getting older, and somehow they were younger. But I loved it because it was like a nourishment. I was always kept abreast of music or new films or new theater artists. And you talk a lot about that, about when we don't combine the generations, we are losing as a culture.
No, absolutely. And we're losing as individuals, too. And I think it's important that older folk reach out for younger folk across all whatever those barriers are that divide us, because when that can happen, and it's happened a lot in my life by intentional acts of inviting and mentoring for those who choose it, when we connect the older and the younger, it's like connecting the poles of a battery, and new energy flows for everyone concerned. And it's a very powerful thing, I think, to just rejoin the pieces of the human community by knocking down these artificial walls that keep us apart from one another. You know, I think, and I'm sure a lot of people think, how much better in this society we would take care of people in deep need if they weren't sequestered away in parts of the city or institutions that we don't want to go to. If we cross them more often in the daily course of our lives, and let that compassion flow, that empathy flow. We have a big rediscovery job to do around the question, whatever happened to empathy in the United States of America? And I'm hoping that in the years ahead, there will be people reclaiming that critical human quality by being honest about themselves, about their own need for empathy. And of course, then meeting that by reaching empathetically to others.
You talk about changing the metaphor, and you mentioned about inviting people to join the orchestra, and that struck a chord with me because we do a lot of corporate workshops and a lot of what people call team building. And we actually, we call it Ensemble, our group. Sheldon Patinkin, who is one of the early geniuses at Second City, used to say that there's that old metaphor, your team is only as good as its weakest member, but in an ensemble, your team is only as good as its ability to compensate for its weakest member, because we're going to be the weakest member at some point. Wouldn't we want them to hold us up rather than, you know, let us down? Right. And I think we do need those new metaphors because the old ones aren't serving us.
Yeah, absolutely. So not only build on our own mistakes, but build it creatively on other people's mistakes in a graceful, affirming way.
You talk a lot about white privilege in your work, which I appreciate, and I'm curious what that journey was like for you generationally speaking. I think I say this in the past couple of days. I just heard on the radio today, there's that Bob Woodward book that's coming out where he was talking to Trump and basically sort of saying, have you examined at all your white privilege? And very much trying to sort of say, like, I think he's examined it and recognized it. And Trump, of course, won't even have it, won't see it.
He told Woodward, you drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you?
Yes, that's what he said, you drank the Kool-Aid.
Like we're supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that, you know, I'm just a quick autobiographical note, which is that when I finished my PhD in Berkeley in 1969, fully intending in the prior years to go into academia with it, the cities were burning.
Yeah.
My heroes had been assassinated. And it really came powerfully to me that I needed to do my sociology not in the halls of academe, but in the streets of the cities. And so I went to Washington, D.C., and I became a community organizer, working especially in white communities that were being redlined, which, as I think most people know or should know, was a very intentional act on the part of the government and business interests to deprive certain communities, those that contained mostly people of color, of investment and resources, and focus those investments and resources in predominantly white communities. So, you know, when it drives me a little nuts when people ask, so how did these ghettos happen? Isn't it just laziness and so forth? No, it's an intentional policy act on the part of a very racist country.
Yeah.
And so I found myself early on at age 30 or so working as a community organizer with some really extraordinary Black organizers who were telling me, we don't want you working down here in the central city because you're white and you just don't get it. But we will partner with you in working, in you working among your own people, the white people who don't get it. And that was a huge, you know, learning for me too. It was a kind of improv. They were flipping the script. And yeah. I think that, you know, improv is partly about flipping the script. And so starting at a pretty young age, and then through the travels I've had since then, I've just had a lot of exposure to a lot of really strong, clear leaders, thinkers, activists, and activities that relate to race. And yet, at the same time, I'm from Wilmette, Illinois. I grew up in an all-white community where the Jews were two suburbs away.
You and me both,
In Glencoe. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, there were a dozen forms of discrimination and bigotry, anti-Catholic bigotry, I remember very clearly. And if anyone remembers the Kennedy campaign, they can touch in with that. And so my view of the world was very, very narrow until I went to New York City for a first step in schooling and then out to Berkeley in the 60s and the great social movements that were happening there. And so slowly it started to seep into me that this wasn't just about being a do-gooder and checking off the, okay, I've done something in relation to race box on my resume, but it was about an ongoing transformation of my own consciousness and understanding. And so these days, and I won't go any deeper into this unless you want me to, but these days, I not only am very, very clear that I and every white person is drenched in white privilege. I think all all white people say to me, well, wait a minute, bad things happen to me or my cousin or my uncle or whatever. And I say, well, I'm sorry about that, but I can almost guarantee you it wasn't because of the color of your skin.
Right.
That run-in with the cops or that failure to get a job or a loan or whatever. It wasn't just because of the skin you were born with. And the other thing I talk about that is, I guess, a more recent revelation for me over the last decade or so is that it's a cop-out for white people to equate white supremacy, which is a step beyond white privilege, to equate white supremacy with wearing a hood and burning a cross and on someone's lawn. White supremacy is an inner attitude that I once had unconsciously, that somehow the white way is the normative way.
Right.
That despite the small fraction of the world's population that is white, that there's something more normal and normative about the white way of doing stuff. That never led me to hate anybody, but it certainly set up a barrier. And across that barrier were people I found strange or exotic or inexplicable, not dangerous, but just I don't get it, and I don't get why they can't do it the white way. I didn't say that consciously, but the attitude was there. And that plants the seed for something a lot worse. And I think it's a form of white supremacy with which many, many whites are inflicted.
And I think there's a extra tension right now, which is holding and understanding all of that, recognizing the sort of dire threat that's in front of us, but still trying not to otherize Trump supporters. I mean, and trying to, we can't do this alone. This is not going to. And so, talk. I'm just curious, especially now. It's a couple of years since you wrote the book, because you do talk about this need of staying in civil discourse. It's hard, though, right?
It's very hard. And you know, the book is Healing the Heart of Democracy, which was written in 2011. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in it, to simplify the case I try to make there, one of the things that I work pretty hard on is this notion that civil discourse doesn't mean just minding our tongues. You know, we certainly must mind our tongues on some level and not resort to crude, gross insults of the sort that we've become very accustomed to in our public discourse because the president engages in so much of it. But civil discourse is really about valuing our differences. And so the question becomes, is it possible for me to value my difference with, let's say, a person, a white person, who harbors racist ideas and advocates for racist policies? I think there's a limit on the answer to that question, but here's one approach. I am in relation to this person. I have to begin with that premise, because no matter what, he or she lives in the same world I do. And so what their truth is impacts me. What my truth is impacts them. When I'm in the presence of racist discourse or homophobic discourse or misogynistic discourse, what I often revert to is to say, wait, you need to understand that what you're saying right now is about people I know and love and care for. And so what you're saying is an insult to me. Mm-hmm. It's wounding to me. I think the argument, it's wounding to someone who's not in this room, just doesn't go very far. No. That's abstract. But if I'm able to look at someone in my family or with whom I'm in a conversation and say, you and I have something to work out at this very moment because you're trampling on some things that I hold dear. If we can go on from that, another approach anyway is to invite storytelling between people of contrary political views. There are programs that one can learn about online, for example, where contentious issues like abortion are explored in workshops where at the beginning of the day, the participants are forbidden from telling anyone what their position on the issue is. Instead, they are coached in how to tell the story of their own life experience, which led them to this belief. A day of good storytelling, and this is part of the work of theater, of any sort, a day of good storytelling can really prepare the ground for something more human and more grounded, something that might actually grow, so that by the end of the day, when people are free to say what position they came to, people have the realization, oh my gosh, two very similar experiences can lead people to two different conclusions. But the experience is something we can all respect and somehow, you know, feel empathy for. We person may have come to a very different conclusion than we did, but we've heard the story in a human scale way. And we can feel for that person in a way that creates an ongoing container for the conversation. I do think, Kelly, that there are extreme points, and you know, a lot of us think a lot about the rise of the Third Reich, about fascism as a political movement. We wonder, or have wondered, what would we have done if we had been in Germany in the 30s? And we saw the brown shirts in the street, and we saw this buildup toward what eventually became the myth of Aryan superiority and the murder of, you know, 10, 15 million people, including 6 million Jews, just because of who they were. Hmm. Well, I'm not saying we're there yet, but I do think that authoritarianism, even fascism, is an energy that's in this current force field. So that question for me is no longer theoretical. And I just feel a need to stay engaged with it in terms of people who see things very differently from the way I do.
Yeah, I guess it would instigate the angry Quaker in you.
Yeah, right. What's an angry Quaker to do, you know?
What is an angry Quaker to do? I can't believe that folk song hasn't been written. It really... So we always end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when people are together making something out of nothing, they actually don't... They can't get anywhere by saying no, and they don't actually get that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and in order to explore and heighten these ideas. So I'm curious, and I said to you even before we started taping, you have lived a yes and life, but I'm wondering if you have a story for us.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's a great question. And what I'll do in answer or in response, Kelly, is to loop back to that moment in 1969 when I'm getting my PhD and I decide to bail out on academic life and become a community organizer in Washington, D.C. instead. A lot of people at that time, my mentors and my peers and some in my family, were kind of asking, have you gone mad? I mean, you've done all this work to get to a place where you could have a good, secure job and rise in the ranks. Some of my mentors had me pegged as a young college dean or president. And you're walking away from all that to go into a situation where you have to raise your own salary every quarter to keep doing this hard work on redlining and anti-racism work. What's gotten into you? And it was interesting for me, and this really does become a yes and story. It's interesting for me that instinctively I started saying to folks, I really can't give you a compelling answer to that question, except an answer that's compelling to me. And that is, what I'm doing is something I can't not do. Mm. So what I'm doing is something I can't not do, which isn't to say I was wild crazy about it. It's just that at some deep level, I had an instinct, even as the father of three kids, who wanted to provide for them, you know, at least through college, that taking this road, which wasn't well rewarded financially and which might well have disappeared me off the radar as a writer, speaker, et cetera, things that came to me later in life, taking that road was a very anxious move and fraught with all kinds of fears and worries, and yet I continued to can't not do it. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how to put that sentence together. But
well, it's a both and. It's, I mean, I think you started to say that too, and yeah. Yeah, we're both huge Merton fans.
Exactly. And so the and for me, yes and, is that, and 50 years later, I'm really glad that I took that path less traveled. Because it gave me stuff to write about and talk about. And I, you know, if I had become, an associate professor of sociology at a state university somewhere, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you.
No.
Which I'm delighted to be.
Yeah, as am I. Parker Palmer, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
one survived. From the culture, no one survived.